Hey, listener, it's me, Zero Time All-Star Trevor May from MCA Media, the ultimate destination for discussions about tech, gaming, content creation, and everything in between. I just wanted to pop in and let you know two very important things. One, you smell incredible today. Two, the May Contain Action Network now has an ever-expanding catalog of great shows, like the D&D-centric Forgotten Pass, Goblins and Growlers, and Quid Pro Roll, or the phenomenal Fortnite podcast in Vaulted, hosted by Squatting Dog. Give them a listen, level up your podcast game, and have some fun. Shows are linked in the show notes.
Hey Goblins, Brandon here. If you enjoy what we do and you'd like to help support us create more and maybe even take the podcast to weekly, then the best way right now that you can support us is to head over to patreon.com/goblinsgrowlers. You can find all the different stuff we do there, one-page dungeons, bonus audio for things, all kinds of stuff. So head on over there, and even if it's just a dollar or, you know, however much you're comfortable doing, or if you can't put anything toward the Patreon, just tell a friend about it. Tell somebody about the podcast. That's another great way to support us. So, patreon.com/goblinsgrowlers, and we'll see y'all soon.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Goblins and Growlers podcast. I'm Josh Maltby at Black Cloak DM on the social medias.
And I'm Brandon Dingus at Wave Brandalore on similar but not exact social medias to Josh. How are you doing, Josh?
Doing pretty well. And how about yourself?
I'm doing all right. That's all the small talk we get, so Scott doesn't yell at us when he's editing the episode, probably in the next day or two.
I feel like fans are going to start thinking that Scott is some sort of like taskmaster, and really it's just that Scott wants us to have content when we have problems with our audio, and I can respect that.
He's technically the producer of this podcast. Real quick, before we get into anything, something I just thought of.
Yes.
No, actually, never mind. I was going to say, and we'll just leave this in because this is what happens. I was going to say, we're going to be at Triad Anime Con this weekend, but this is coming out the Monday we get back.
We'll have just been at Triad Anime Con this weekend, and I'm sure that we'll have seen a lot of cool people and been excited to see them. Maybe done some high fives.
Yeah. See a lot of cool people from last year down in Winston-Salem. Janice, if I speak to you and your daughter this weekend, this is a shout out to you.
Hell yeah.
Josh has very dutifully gone through and prepared a menu of topics for us to discuss tonight. Nothing so in-depth as kind of what we spent the last couple of episodes doing, because there was Born from Ice, and then we talked about the NASA TTRPG. But now we've got a mix of things, starting off with some news, because there's an interview with Chris Cox, the Hasbro CEO.
Yes. Specifically, the news is highlighting the fact that he was saying things about how much he really likes the idea of having an AI product or two coming out every couple of months.
Well, yeah. And there's a lot of context to that. Like, I can understand
and explain a lot of this. Necessary.
And just to throw it out there, this interview is with VentureBeat.com, and it's by Dean Takahashi. I've never read any of Dean Takahashi's stuff before. And in fact, I've never heard of VentureBeat.com before. And I said, Josh, what's VentureBeat.com? I've never heard of this website. He's like, oh, I found it because they had the interview with Chris Cox. And that was it.
Yeah, this was literally, I was trawling through TTRPG news sites, and they were like, oh, VentureBeat had an interview with Chris Cox where he said that he wants to see more AI content. And I was like, well, let me go look at this interview. And I was like, well, with context, it's not quite so crazy as it might sound. And more importantly, as the one place I saw was speculating, they were like, does this mean that WotC will need to double back on their, we're not going to do AI stuff with our content? And I was like, no, it does not.
Yeah, it's an interesting interview, and I recommend anybody read it. We'll put the link in the show notes. But it's your typical business CEO kind of interview. It's a very softball sort of situation. It was interesting because as I was reading through it, I could see in a couple of different places where the interviewer was dropping the word layoffs and talking about tech layoffs. And
it seems like they were trying to bait him into talking about the ballyhooed layoffs from Hasbro last year, but he didn't really take the bait on it. And he would just he talked about layoffs in tech in sort of a more broad sense, and just how, you know, it's different because there's not as much capital floating around as there used to be. You're talking about when he took over, and was because essentially when he took over Hasbro, his directive was to move them more into digital gaming, which you could argue with Baldur's Gate 3 he's done very successfully. And one thing that a lot of people who are listening to this may be sleeping on, but like really Baldur's Gate 3 is right up there sort of with Monopoly Go for Hasbro right now, because Monopoly Go is just an absolute insane hit for them, and, you know, great for them. But really what he's talking about with using AI is he's talking about using it as sort of interactive content within a lot of their games. So it's not sort of a reflexive thing, because I think we all think about like, oh, they're talking about art assets, because that's just where everything's been on fire for Hasbro and WotC specifically.
Or writing assets, either or.
Yeah. Yeah. It's harder to do writing assets, because really no matter what you do with a writing asset, you have to have some sort of human editor go back through it and essentially do double, in my opinion, as a professional editor, do double the work. If you had just gotten somebody to write it, you could have had it written and edited in probably about half the time that it's going to take for AI to write it and then have it edited in a really humanistic way.
We're looking at you, Willy Wonka experience.
There's a lot of problems about the Willy Wonka experience that we could talk about. And I would say that on that list of problems is very near the bottom. For anybody who's unfamiliar, for whatever reason, with what we're talking about, just Google Willy Wonka Experience UK and just look at the picture of the sad woman who got paid very little money to be an Oompa Loompa.
who at the time of the photo was supposed to be handing out jelly beans, but had run out of jelly beans like 30 minutes prior.
Yeah, she looks like she's standing at a Skyrim alchemy table, just very, very sad. You really got me off track on that. But yeah, I remember I heard about that, and then I saw some pictures from it, and I was just absolutely aghast at what happened. It's like as somebody who's planned and run public events, that's just sort of like a nightmare scenario for me, that's the kind of reception that you get.
Well, the guy behind it has also released a bunch of AI written books.
Yeah.
So that's who he is as a person.
That's how we got to talking about that. I'd forgotten because we'd wandered so far off the path. But yeah, so Chris Cox is not talking about using AI to write D&D modules. He's not using it to create art assets for D&D. He's talking about creating large language models for their games. And, you know, anybody who's used ChatGPT or Bard or anything like that, sort of, even if you don't understand it, you understand what a large language model is. It's essentially the bucket from which those interfaces pull all the information that they then remix and regurgitate back at you in some sort of ghoulish representation of original content. I mean, it's really just sort of it's Frankenstein. It's taking little bits of something else and reconstituting it as an individual being. But without digging like really, really deep into it, you know, he's talking about, I think, if you want to, and this isn't outlined in the story, but what I'm taking away from it, and let's put it in a D&D context, because that's what we talk about on here, is if you wanted to have some sort of single player experience, or maybe a multiplayer experience, but nobody wanted to be the GM, you could set some parameters up for a sort of AI GM, and it would draw on what's in the large language model and try and create some scenarios for you. And the reason I say that is because he talks about, you know, D&D has like 50 years of content that they can, and he used the word mine. He's like, we can mine that, because this is all part of a broader discussion in the article about intellectual property and what goes into the LLM. And, you know, obviously that controls what comes out of the LLM. And he very much was talking about wanting to make sure that anything that goes into an LLM that they create, it needs to be like properly licensed. They're not going to do essentially the Midjourney and just dump everything in there. And then whatever the result is, it's sort of tainted and bastardized just by the fact that it's created from stolen parts.
Yeah, which I think is the crucial component here. We're not talking about ripping the entire internet and then going, oh, the internet will now run you a D&D campaign. Mm-hmm. We're talking about uploading the entire library of past adventures.
Right.
And then saying, let the D&D archive run you a game.
Which yeah.
I still feel like it's not going to be as ideal an experience, but I could see that being fascinating. And at least in that case, the people who wrote it have been paid for their work. The work is owned by the company that will be creating the large language model from it. And no one's getting hurt. Like, this isn't stealing jobs from, you know, Hasbro employees. Because they don't have Hasbro employees who run old modules.
And if the AI is successful enough, they may not have Hasbro employees.
I think we both know that's not exactly realistic.
Yeah. It's I don't know. I think it will be terrible, but in a beautiful way. Just because, you know, load 50 years of first party content in there and it's going to come out with just some wild stuff. And obviously, they're just not going to dump it in a bucket, mix it around and have it poured out. There will be parameters around what gets spit out in a particular situation. You know, you'll be able to specify lots of things. But have you ever played around with character.ai?
No, I don't think that's one that I've messed around with.
It's probably right now my favorite AI sort of content interactivity generator thing, because what you do is you create a character and then you write a bio of them and include traits and stuff like that. You can really freeform it for whatever you want. And then there's other, you know, I could get into real detail for it, but that's the key thing. And then you have to go through and, you know, set a bunch of other parameters and things. And then you can essentially have an interaction with this character. It creates a chatbot sort of based on a lot of those traits. So,
okay.
Once upon a time, I did one for George Costanza and just had a conversation with him. And it was very much sort of a caricature of George Costanza, because that's what these kind of things do. They have to pull the caricature element out of it because it's not sophisticated enough and it doesn't have enough data to draw nuance about, you know, an actual person. So it's right. Interesting. But it creates the kind of one-dimensional characters that you might be like, I could use this as an NPC interaction, like just walking through the city or something like that. It could be useful for that kind of thing. I wouldn't use it to develop like sort of a fully fleshed out character that I wanted to put in my dramatist persona in a book that I was writing. But if somebody's like, oh, what's the backstory of this guy sitting at the bar in the tavern or whatever, then I can just come up with something and get some background for it. And that's what I think he's talking about here, is being able to use it to generate those kind of interactions, lightly guide you through it. Because like nothing is going to be able to live up to a living, breathing, organic mind that can improv on a dime and understands context and body language and stuff like that about how comfortable you are. Like try throwing up an X at an AI GM and it won't understand really what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And the other part of what he was talking about with the licensing aspect of this is he got a question about user generated content and how that could come to be incorporated into D&D. And the interviewer specifically called out stuff like Minecraft and Roblox and how they rely heavily on user generated content to keep the experience fresh. I think what he's going for here is saying, like, you could take your stuff and submit it to the large language model, probably with some kind of release or something like that, and it can get incorporated. And so maybe there would be like a library of NPCs. Somebody, you know, in Iowa has created an NPC that you've decided you want to use because the description sounds interesting, right? They've uploaded it to the LLM, so you can use it. Like, thinking, using just that character.ai analogy there. Does that make sense?
I'm just thinking about like Roblox is already kind of a troublesome entity in general because it's ostensibly for children.
Mm-hmm.
But if you write a game for Roblox and you get people to spend Robux on it, then you get a small percentage of what you've written, the fees.
Mm-hmm.
And like,
and we don't know that they wouldn't have that kind of setup, to be fair.
We don't. I was thinking more in the vein of, if I were a third-party content creator, would I want to create something, put it into a large language model where it then regurgitates the components of that thing into other people's games? Would I be chill with that? Or would I be like, well, now I don't have any control over it?
Well, I don't think it matters as of right now or in the near future, simply because the way the third-party tabletop economy is set up right now, nobody's going to be doing this. Nobody who has experience creating content is going to be doing this for free. So you're still going to have to be paying for quality. There will probably be some people of name, of note, who would be willing to be sort of the first toes into the pond in trying to monetize some of their creations in that way. Like, I'm thinking like, and I'm, you know, this, I don't intend this to be a shade throw or anything like that, but like Matt Mercer. If I were Matt Mercer and Watsi Hasbro came to me and said, we would love it if we could give you this dump truck full of money and we take a lot of the characters and scenarios and other content you've created and buy it from you so we can put it in our large language model and then resell it to people who want to incorporate it into their campaigns, and you will get X percentage of that. Because if you get, like, if you got Matt Mercer on board, if you get Wolfgang Bauer on board, people like that, then other people are going to be like, oh, well, it must be fine then. You know, that I'm just spitballing that. I literally didn't think of that until you said that and it entered my mind. But I think I see that as a potential future for it. But getting back to my original point, I don't think in the short term, like let's say tomorrow they spun this up and they had some sort of large language model that they were using to develop content for D&D and share it out to people. Nobody would use it, at least nobody who wanted any kind of quality content would do it. It would be like essentially getting wares back in the day. Like, you could either pay for something or you could maybe get a sketchy version of it on wares for free illegally, because you're going to have competing VTTs that are going to be incorporating this. Alchemy is going to be doing this. World Anvil, like, they're all going to have their own thing. And whoever has the most lucrative remuneration model, the most creator friendly remuneration model, is going to be the one that wins. Asterisk. Because who's the one who always wins? Watsi. Watsi always wins. It's Winners of the Coast. And everybody else comes, everybody else is going to come second, but it's just a question of who's the strong second. It's the same discussion we were having over during OGL about who the also ran is going to be. Like, now that everything is just going to be five, 5e still, basically, like, is that going to be Tales of the Valiant? I don't know. But it'll be the same thing with whatever sort of digital marketplace for AI content there is.
Yeah, and I get where you're coming from. I think for me personally, I have such a revulsion at the idea of someone ripping up what I've written and taking the individual pieces and then ransom note style pasting them back into an adventure, that the idea of feeding my adventures into a large language model is like, I don't know about that.
Well, maybe it doesn't even work that way. Maybe let's talk about one of my favorite things that you've ever done, the Liar's Axe adventures. Like, let's say Liar's Axe Part 1. Watsi's like, we would like that. You say, sure. And you sell it to them and they give you $5. And now they've got that in the system. Now, another way that this could work is that each individual adventure or module or campaign or however you want to refer to it, whatever kind of play timeline you're working on there, can be just a thing. And what the LLM does is it uses the context of the adventure to help GM it, essentially, within its limitations.
I could maybe see that working out. Although even then, I think, I don't know. It's something I struggle with a bit because it feels a bit like the old MUDs, where you'd have just like a text-based adventure in front of you. You could be participating in that adventure with other people, but really you were there to explore a text-based world by yourself, doing whatever it is you might do. This seems like it would be kind of that direction. I don't know. I will be curious to see what actually comes out of that concept. I'm hesitant. Very hesitant. And not because I think WotC's going to do something that gets them into legal hot water, because I think, generally speaking, they are smarter than that. Their legal team, at the very least, is like, no, don't do that. But yeah. I'm still a little, I guess, nervous about the concept of, I mean, I don't think I would give WotC an open license to something, but I guess if I was like, if I was Kobold Press, and I've got all these books, all these adventures, all these monster, like all of these things, I very well might be like, you know what? You can't have anything I've published in the last year and a half, 2 years. You can absolutely have my archives. You can pay me oodles of money to make use of my archives in your large language model or whatever it may be. Especially if the agreement is WotC can only use that data inside their large language model. They're not allowed to then also take my monster blocks and put them inside a new adventure that they're writing.
Right. And let me try to figure out how to contextualize this, because as with many things, I look at it through a lens of wrestling. Right. So so for the longest time, there was, you know, the Forbidden Door. And that's, you know, wrestlers working for this promotion. And this is in modern wrestling, not territory wrestling. That was an entirely different era. But in sort of modern wrestling, like, you know, late 80s, rise of the WWF and beyond, there it's, you know, there's a Forbidden Door. If you're working for this company, you can't also go do dates for this company, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And increasingly, it became more of like a WWE thing, where if you work for WWE, you were exclusive, even though you're an independent contractor legally. But that's a whole other thing. But if you worked for, you know, smaller federations or something like that, like if you worked for NWA or I don't know, I guess even AEW these days, like you can go do dates for other indies or really small promotions or things like that. And they always call it the Forbidden Door because you can't walk through it. And but now, since the, so, you know, since Vince McMahon has rightfully been deposed and after the sale to TKO, you're starting to see a little bit of a change there. You're starting to see WWE wrestlers showing up in some smaller federations. And there was like a taste of this 5 or 6 years ago with some of the smaller like international promotions that weren't directly competing. But you see it a lot more now. Where am I going with this? You mentioned Kobold Press, and it's interesting to note that we're starting to see sort of a similar Forbidden Door kind of sea change going on with Dungeons and Dragons, because we're starting to see third-party content showing up on D&D Beyond, like Tome of Beasts from Kobold Press, right? So
right.
Where the barrier's being broken down already. Like, WotC, I think, is understanding that they have nothing to fear from everybody because they always win. And if they can be a platform for more content, that's whether or not it's their own content, if they become not necessarily just content producers, but content distributors, then they still win. They still monetize. So that's where I see, if they're the first ones to develop like a really solid use for AI DMing with existing content, then that's where everybody's going to go. But getting back to what I was saying too about also RANs, like if Alchemy ends up coming up with something that's just as good or almost just as good, people will be inclined to use that, probably because it's going to be more of an open environment, less of a walled garden than what you're going to have with D&D Beyond. And some people are going to use it just because it's not WotC.
Yeah, I mean, there is that. I think the point where I start to have my hesitation is that I feel like there's a huge difference between we will let you host our content on your virtual tabletop and we will let your large language model devour and digest all of the sweet smackerels our content.
I'm not suggesting an equivalence there. I'm saying somebody like Alchemy, somebody like Roll20, probably not Roll20, because my biggest criticism of Roll20 is it looks and functions exactly the same as it did, you know, 12 years ago when I was using it. But
the only platform I've seen that looks more Java than Roll20 was Vassal back in the day.
But what I'm saying is they will begin to develop or license LLMs of their own. Maybe they're more limited in scope. Maybe they don't have all the functionality, but they're not going to just be hosting stuff on their VTT. They're going to be incorporating it like that.
Yeah, I suppose. And I can definitely see, especially where smaller time creators who already are not making money in places like DM's Guild are going to be like, look, wherever I can get money for the stuff that I've written.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Especially if it's not an exclusive agreement. Where yeah. I can keep selling my stuff on DM's Guild, I can also get this fat check from WotC to let them use the LLM on my stuff. Like, I am all for whoever wants to get out there and get that bag to get out there and get that bag.
Yeah.
I just personally, the concept of feeding my content into an LLM is like, oh, God. Oh, I don't know about that.
Yeah. And
jeepers, mister.
Let's be honest about it too. Like, people need to get their stuff out there as much as possible, because nobody's going to become famous just by writing tabletop stuff and putting it out into the world. It's like somebody in ninth grade saying that, what's your plan after you graduate from high school? Oh, I'm going to go play in the NFL. Like, you can't guarantee that kind of thing. You can't guarantee I'm going to make it in music. It's like looking beyond an event horizon, right? Like, there's nothing you can possibly do to guarantee success in what is now such a crowded niche field as tabletop gaming writing. It's just, you can't guarantee it. Your only hope is to just throw yourself out there in enough different places in enough different ways and hope that you have a unique hook that interests people. And you know, if you're writing Elves in the Forest kind of adventures, that's probably not it. You're going to have to find sort of a new angle of approach. So the more people can get themselves out there, the better. That's why I don't like DM's Guild, because, you know, it locks you in to a certain degree.
Well, not only does it lock you in a little bit, it's not word for word. It's paying you worse than almost anywhere in the industry would pay you, which is baffling to me, because
in an industry that already pays you very, very little.
Not only that, but most of DM's Guild costs comes from just operating the servers that they have. I mean, yes, there is cost affiliated with that 100%. And their staff that's maintaining all of that needs to make their money too. I just don't get why you can publish a 30-page adventure and then be making pennies on the word. Like,
right.
It's insane to me.
Because it's easy. Because they provide infrastructure and a platform for people to not have to worry about it. I mean,
well, and I'm not throwing shade at anybody who decides to publish on DM's Guild, because again, get that bag wherever you can.
Yeah.
I just feel like DM's Guild's percentages to me seem high for what DM's Guild is offering.
Yeah. I mean, if you're going to, you know, I would just say choose itch.io. It's just the more creator friendly version of that.
Right.
Yeah. That's about all I had talking about the AI interview. At the end of the day, like, the idea of a headline of, you know, Hasbro CEO says, let's get more into AI. It's designed to shock. It's designed to grab your attention. But really, it sounds responsible the way he's approaching it. But again, I don't put a lot of stock in this interview, because it's your standard CEO interview where they're not going to say anything really controversial. You know, one thing he did say that was controversial, at least to me, that I thought was interesting, was he was talking about playing D&D with his, you know, middle-aged friends and everything. And he'll say, yeah, you know, I will use AI generated art for that. I'm not monetizing it. I'm not commercializing it or anything. I'm just creating it. And I'm putting it into a PowerPoint presentation that I then use as a map for the game. I thought it was interesting that he admitted to using that in his personal games. I'm not saying there's anything right or wrong about that. I've talked to a lot of artists who are like, hey, you know, as long as you're using it sort of as a sort of a wish factory of the kind of a picture that you'd like to see, or just some idea that you had to see what it would look like, if you're, as long as you're not turning around and trying to make money off of it, that's generally fine. But I know there's a lot of different opinions on that, because, you know, it's, there's a non-zero chance that he's created something and used it in one of his games that featured stolen work, just because of the way those models were developed.
Well, and not just that, but when you think about someone like Chris Cox could afford to commission a small-time artist to create his wish image that he really wants, if he were so inclined.
Right. That actually makes him feel a little bit more like us, because he's somebody who just can't be bothered to go to the trouble to do that for his home game, you know?
There's a bit of that, yeah. And I think the argument that I could see artists making is, hey, you know, you would commission an artist because you couldn't find this picture that you're looking for by doing a Google image search. And if you were going to commission an artist because you couldn't find it by doing a Google image search, it seems messed up. You can go to DALL-E or whatever and say, show me an orc with blue skin and a handprint tattoo on his face. And like, you can get that. You can generate that, and you can go and pick your favorite one and then use it. I don't know. I would hope that at the end of the day, folks are using AI image generators exclusively for stuff they really don't care about. And then anytime they're like, you know what, I actually care about how this turns out, instead of trying to learn to prompt the image generator better, they're going out and they're commissioning an artist. Because artists, they're not super cheap, but we're also not talking about an arm and a leg here.
Yeah. And you know how much Chris Cox makes in a year?
I imagine it is somewhere in the seven digits, maybe eight.
Close. His total yearly compensation is about $9.4 million. But he also directly owns a small portion, like 0.15% of the company stocks, worth $11.3 million.
Oh, my word.
He can pay an artist.
Yeah, he could 100% afford to pay an artist. I get if you're having a moment where you're trying to describe something desperately and you're like, it's like, oh God, it's like this, but with it, I'm having trouble illustrating with my words what I'm trying to describe. In those situations, I think anybody is valid to go, I'm going to punch all of this into a thing and see if I can get something that's close.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think that's valid. I guess the only rebuttal I would have to that is Chris Cox, as the CEO of Hasbro, as the person who's sort of deciding the direction of Wizards of the Coast ultimately, right? Because he's, you know, Dan Rawson's boss and all those other people. He has a really good opportunity here to publicly set an example for this kind of thing. And I think saying I use AI art in my home games was not the thing to say, especially with what WotC has gone through over the last year. Like, I don't use AI art in any of my home games. My use of AI art is strictly limited to a channel I have in a Discord server I have with my high school friends, so we can put like Steve Harvey and Louis Anderson into compromising situations with Midjourney prompts.
Less likely photos of George Costanza.
Yes. Exactly. And I just, you know, I don't use that in anything we create, obviously. I don't use it for any of my personal stuff that I create. I just don't think it's a good practice to fall into, because it becomes sort of something that you lean on too heavily. And, you know, to sort of end what has become a 30-minute long screed of mine to try to position myself as somebody in sort of the AI D&D thought leadership space, I will say to Chris Cox, like, you have a real opportunity to sort of disavow the use of AI art in gaming, and you've chosen not to do it. And I think you're hiding behind the fact that you're using it in your home game. But I think this is a good opportunity for you to step out there and actually be a leader in the space to other creators and say, I'm not going to do that anymore.
Yeah. I mean, again, there's a lot of artists out there and their commission rates aren't that crazy.
Yeah. The YouTube headline for this is going to be nobody podcaster calls out Hasbro CEO.
Yeah, take that, Chris Cox.
Yeah.
I bet you really feel on blast now.
Just a suggestion. If he wanted to be seen as more of an ethical leader with the moral high ground on a lot of this stuff.
If he wanted to be viewed as more of a man of the people, he could always come on our show and explain himself.
That would be wild. That would be absolutely wild. Get Chris Cox on this show.
Oh, my word. So we do have a couple of other news items that we were looking at getting into, a slightly smaller fare than the headline grabbing Chris Cox wants to make more AI products, ! The top of which I was very excited to see kind of pivoting from Hasbro into WotC on D&D Beyond. They've started talking about Quests from the Infinite Staircase, which is going to be 6 remastered adventurers.
This year's anthology book.
Yeah. Only it's an anthology of things that have already been written. So really, it's like a remaster anthology book.
It's interesting. I'm excited for it. I think I mentioned this when we talked about the release schedule for this year. And this sounds bad, and it probably sounds counter to a lot of stuff I've said in the past, but I'm more excited for this than I am for some of the previous anthology books that have come out, just because this sort of goes, bringing it back to Chris Cox, this is part of the 50 years of D&D history, essentially, that they're going back and mining, but they're doing it in a way that a lot of us have wanted, which is creating 5th edition updates of a lot of older, well-known modules.
Right. So the concept behind this anthology is that you can either run them as standalone adventures or as a collection to do a pseudo campaign. It seems like they could be tied together, but very loosely. But what they've done is arrange it so that it's a level.
Yeah. The Infinite Staircase is just this extra dimensional thing that connects all of these together. The Infinite Staircase is constructed from the very loose thread that ties all these together.
Well, I was going to say the Infinite Staircase sounds like yet another excuse for multiplanar travel.
Yeah. Yeah. They're really ringing that bell really loud these days.
Well, it does make going back to some of these old adventures, especially some of the more ridiculous ones, a little bit simpler. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, you already know which one I want to talk about, but you know, feel free to just run through them.
Yeah, I was going to run through the list real quick just so that everybody's in the know. They're going to have the Lost City for 1st to 3rd level characters, When a Star Falls for 4th to 5th level characters, Beyond the Crystal Cave for 6th level characters, Pharaoh for 7th to 8th level characters, The Lost Caverns of Sojkanth for 9th to 10th level characters, and then finally, the one that Brandon and I are the most excited about, Expedition to the Barrier Peaks for 11th to 13th level characters.
Stephen Colbert's own favorite D&D module of all time, Expedition to Barrier Peaks. And the interesting thing about all these, I guess it's less interesting, more just I like it, is that these are all from the 70s and 80s. I think the latest year on any of these is 1984.
That sounds right. I'm looking at the list now, and yeah. I think you're spot on with that.
Yeah. And I've heard of all of these, but I don't know a lot about any of them, aside from Barrier Peaks, because I've read through that whole book. Like, once upon a time, back in the beginnings of COVID, we did like a stream where we just talked about that. It wasn't any kind of like formal podcast episode or anything like that. We were just chatting about it. And it's full of great stuff. If you're not familiar with Expedition to Barrier Peaks, and if you're listening to this podcast, I don't really understand how you're not, but you should definitely go look it up. If you want to play it, don't go look it up. But also, like, the trope that it relies on is nowadays very predictable. So it wouldn't be as big as, it's not the kind of, you know, Luke, I am your father kind of twist that it was back when it came out, but it's very exciting.
Yeah, I am really intrigued because I recall a lot of the rules for stuff in Expedition of the Barrier Peaks were heavily, heavily AD&D, like so heavily. And I'm really keen to see how they've modified things to work better with 5e, because that, I imagine, took some work.
Well, yeah. And they said that for all of these, they've pulled out like 30 monsters from each of these and reworked the stat blocks to update them to 5e. And that's interesting because I would bet that over the six of these, there's more than 30 monsters in the originals total. So they must have done a little bit of restringing.
That would make sense. I mean, you don't want, when you're making an anthology book, you don't want a bestiary that comes with it that is the same size as the adventures you've written.
Yeah. And for, and I wonder about size too. Like, I don't think they gave us a page count on this. I could probably look it up on Amazon or something like that. For the, for like on the pre-order page or something to get an idea what the page count is. But I'm thinking about all the detail and all the pages that were in the original Barrier Peaks book and all the maps and stuff. Cause like the maps at the time were very simplistic, which is what you were going to find back in the 80s. Right. Nowadays, that really doesn't fly anymore for modern audiences. So you're going to have to make multiple maps. You're going to have to make detailed maps. Cause like, spoiler for Expedition to Barrier Peaks, it's a spaceship. It's a spaceship in a fantasy world, and you have to go throughout the entire ship and try to figure out what's going on and fight robots and stuff like that. And if I remember correctly from looking at the PDF, which I cannot find now, it was just a massive map.
Well, it was several rather significant maps that would be laid out over the course of however long your adventure took. Because I remember looking through that and being just amazed at how many different kinds of locales they had within this. Because essentially, again, spoilers for Expedition of the Barrier Peaks, the spaceship is essentially the size of a small mountain by itself.
Yeah, the conceit is that it crashed. It crashed at some point in the past and sort of got covered over.
Yeah,
like sort of like the Transformers when they crashed on Earth 4 million years ago.
Right. Exactly. Yes. Oh my God. Can you imagine if at the end of Expedition of the Barrier Peaks, they were like, oh, and we'll be releasing the next adventure in this series, Earthshaker, where the expedition to the Barrier Peaks spaceship turns into a giant robot controlled by gnomes.
Listen, Chris Cox, I know I got your attention earlier. But now I need to ask a favor of you. I really need you to remaster. I need you to have WotC remaster Earthshaker for 5e, please. It's like my favorite module of all time. Please, please do that. I will pay you $60 just for that as a standalone book. Thank you very much.
Oh, that was my
such,
God.
It's such a ridiculous adventure.
I think that covers the basics for Quest from the Infinite Staircase. That's supposed to be coming out July 16th. There are, of course, as per usual, if you pre-order the digital version through D&D Beyond, you get a couple of things early. It doesn't look like this has anything that is unique to D&D Beyond that you don't get at all. But you get like some D&D Beyond maps early from the... I think that's what this is saying. Oh, I see. You get maps that are part of the book when the book releases.
Right.
And then you can also get the Lost Caverns. Yes, the Lost Caverns of Soshganth early.
It says it's a one-shot version of it. So it's Descent into the Lost Caverns of Soshganth. It's a streamlined version of the adventure for ninth level parties. It can be completed, according to them, in a single 3 to 4 hour session, complete with optional tournament scoring rules and a magical surprise for successful adventuring parties. This retro throwback to Gygax's original tournament adventure is sure to evoke the essence of an iconic D&D expedition. I've never played tournament style D&D, and I would be interested to try that sometime.
the closest I've come to playing tournament style D&D is reading a tournament style D&D webcomic.
That's like saying the closest you've come to relations with a woman is reading a romance novel.
I have a much better understanding of them and their heaving bosoms.
Let's move on. speaking of that, you wanted to talk about charity, I think.
Speaking of heaving bosoms, I'm going to give credit to J.R. Zambrano once again.
Our patron saint of news, J.R. Zambrano.
Doing the Lord's work out there. This time, I didn't even go to the Bell of Lost Souls website. I searched for him and found this website called Muckrack, mm-hmm. where you can,
I'm very
if you're
familiar
a
with
writer,
it. Yep.
You can post your profile and then it'll pull articles that you've written. And the top article that he most recently had written 21 hours ago was the Magpie Games RPG Humble Bundle, which I was like, excuse me, what? I went and pulled it up. You can get 30 books from Magpie Games for $35 and benefit Extra Life while you're at it, right? No, mm-hmm. Child's Play. My bad.
Yeah, Child's Play
is the charity.
You can benefit. You can benefit Chucky the murderous doll with your purchase.
Please don't benefit the murderous doll. Please benefit the very good charity that helps children who are in hospitals. So there's a ton of good games in here. There's Masks. There's Root. There's the Avatar TTRPG. And those are just a few of the big names. I said, speaking of heaving bosoms, because they also have Passion de las Passions, which is a TTRPG where you and your table of friends are using, I think it's Powered by the Apocalypse rules.
A lot of this is PBTA.
To perform as best you can a Latin soap opera.
Mm-hmm.
Which... Yeah. Oh my God, that sounds so good.
I forget where I heard about this, but I had heard about this before seeing it on here. And I remember thinking, oh, that's fantastic. I'll probably never play it, but I'm glad it exists. I'm very glad it exists. Masks is interesting. I have been, I'm planning to run a superhero game for my home game coming up soon. And I had originally thought about running Masks because Alex, one of the proprietors of Alpha Comics and Games, conveniently located at Richmond's Willow Lawn, and your wife has talked to me a lot about liking this system. And I was looking into it and I decided against it because it seems like it's geared at more of sort of a Teen Titans kind of situation. And I was looking for more of like a golden age superhero vibe. So I ended up picking up Mutants and Masterminds, and I'm going to do that instead. But having said that, if I had seen this before I committed to that and told my players what we were going to do, I probably would have just bought this and then run Masks regardless, because it's such a great deal to get the main book and then three expansions as part of this, because it's a really good system. Like, I'm a big fan of PBTA systems. The only reason I didn't go with this one is just because I was looking for a different vibe.
For our audio only folks, since Brandon's scrolling through, that is Masks core book plus Halcyon City Herald Collection plus Unbound plus Secrets of Aegis.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a pretty solid collection of just Masks. There's a few things in here I'd never heard of. Mm-hmm. Undying is one of those, which is a diceless vampire role-playing game,
mm-hmm.
which I was like, go on. But the sample text they let you look at, of course, won't let you get into the meat of things. I guess I have to buy it first so I can learn all of the juicy, bloody details. There is The Ward, which is kind of a create your own medical drama / comedy, which Brandon aptly said earlier. So you can choose between ER or Scrubs.
Yeah, or Saint Elsewhere, if you're older like me, and remember that. One of Howie Mandel's first forays into network television.
Howie Mandel.
Mm-hmm.
You said that you've got, and you showed me this, a copy of Crossroads Carnival, which is on here.
Yes, I've got Crossroads Carnival. I bought this, I think, toward the end of last year, because I was interested, or I had remembered wanting to read a little bit more about just the idea of like running a game in a carnival. And I was thinking of like Van Richten's Guide to Ravenloft that had the carnival sort of domain of dread in it. And also I was looking for an example of a PBTA game for something that I was trying to write up, like a really like skeletal game, like game setting that I was trying to write up. And I had a bunch of stuff in PDF, but I wanted something I could actually hold in my hand. So I went to the Magpie website and bought this, and it's really cool. I really like it. And I think I paid like $10 for it, for the print copy of it. So getting it as part of this is just an insane deal.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I think the thing I was most intrigued by reading through here was Passing, the Ashcan edition, which is basically, it's a smaller, it's not the complete core book. It's a starter play. So you can basically just start playing the game mm-hmm. more quickly.
Hence the Ashcan edition.
Right. The concept is that you are shape-shifting aliens who are hidden in a 1950s suburb and are trying to figure out how to get you and the rest of your kind off of Earth after they crash there near Roswell, New Mexico.
It's Coneheads, the game.
Hopefully with less devouring people, but mm-hmm. you never know.
Yeah, and then The Play's the Thing, and By No Means Vulgar, like Shakespearean style TTRPGs. That's cool. What's our last best hope? Oh, okay. During the game, you and your friends will play through a classic disaster movie like Sunshine, Deep Impact, The Core, or Armageddon. My favorite story about Armageddon is Ben Affleck telling the story about his agent trying to get him into that movie. And his agent, it was a guy named Ken Sunshine at the time, called him on the phone and was like, dude, you got to be in this Armageddon movie. You got to do this Armageddon.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah.
And Root is in here as well. It's, you know, that's very popular. People love that.
Root, two expansion books, and a map pack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's if Humblewood is too pricey for you, you've got Root right here. And I'm not saying it's second best or anything like that. It's just affordable.
I mean, at $35 for it and like 16 other games.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So yeah, definitely check this out. How long does this Humble Bundle run through, Josh?
This Humble Bundle will be running until, I just had this up. It was like April 16th, I want to say.
Unprepared.
Let me double check. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so folks will have about 2 weeks from the time this comes out to get it.
Yeah, it's got 17 days remaining as of right now. We're releasing this in about 6 days. There'll be about 11 days left on release day.
Okay. And pivoting off of the Humble Bundle now, I'd like to point out other things that have a time element to them. Born from Ice, the Kickstarter where we interviewed Lauren Small, the creator, not too long ago, has met their funding goal. They were shooting for 40,000 and they've met 40,000 on there. And the next goal that they're going for is 50,000, I believe, because that triggers the stretch goal for them to have Neanderthals as a playable race. And we mentioned this because we got 7 days to go on the Kickstarter as of the time we're recording this. We're recording this on March 26th. So when you get this, you will have a day to get
on
there.
One day.
And you can see right now when we're looking at it, they're still about 8,200 shy, 8,100 shy of 50,000 for the stretch goal. The project funded, that stretch goal they hit there was, they'll have a VTT pack. So they're going to have assets that come with it for virtual tabletop play. So that's cool. but additional species content unlocked at 50,000. So it's going to happen no matter what, but it would just be really cool. If you heard our interview with Lauren, you know how invested I am personally in getting Neanderthals as a playable race for this game.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I would love it. So congratulations to Lauren. I'm glad that no matter what happens now, he's going to be able to release this. We have absolutely no financial stake in this other than I backed it because I want a copy of it.
Well, and at this point it's funded, so you really don't have any financial stake in this other than you backed it and you want Neanderthals.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I have an emotional stake in it now, not a financial stake. Josh, you need to tell them what they need to know?
Well, I could tell them a few things.
Okay.
There's a variety of things I could be telling them. One of those is that they should telephone, telegraph, tell a friend about the Goblins and Growlers podcast, because word of mouth being an exceptional, ludicrous album, right? That's what
you've
been saying?
Correct.
That is not the only thing it's good for. It's also good for bringing people to our show and introducing them to all of the things that we can help them learn about, such as the fact that Chris Cox is not trying to wedge AI into current WotC properties, but might be trying to wedge AI into WotC properties from 40 years ago.
I think it's probably more accurate to say he's trying to feed current WotC properties into AI.
You can find both of us on social media, Brandon at Way of Brandalore, me at Black Cloak DM. You should join us and the conversation at large at our Discord, bit.ly/goblindiscord. That's all lowercase, and that is important when you go to put that in. If you like the sort of things that we are doing and you'd like to find more things that we're doing, you can go to linktr.ee/goblinsandgrowlers, also all lowercase, to find all of our various Goblins and Growlers social media pages, the website, as well as our other show, Quid Pro Roll, which you can find on your podcatcher of choice. That is our sister podcast, where I play a edgier than I'd meant to be half-elf rogue whose parents are both alive and love him very much. And Brandon plays an over-the-hill professional wrestler named Gravy Boat Barnes.
It all comes back to wrestling. Like I said, that's a common point of reference that I have.
Everything circles back around to wrestling.
It's wrestling all the way down. So, yeah, I think that's it. Like I said, if we saw you at Triad, thanks for coming out and saying hi to us. I hope you got a card. I hope you stopped by our table in the vendor hall. I hope you came to some of our panels. Very excited about going there. And we can do an after action report when we record again.
I was going to say, I hope that it was as excellent a time for you as I'm sure it has been for us.
Let me tell you how much fun I had at Triad last year when I went and I got to see Cybertronic Spree for free two nights in a row, along with Professor Shy Guy. It was fantastic. Shy Guy is going to be there again. I'm looking forward to seeing him again. We have a long relationship with Professor Shy Guy because the first Queen City Anime Con we went to as Goblins and Growlers in 2019, Josh borrowed gaffer tape from him so we could tape our sign to the wall because we didn't know what we were doing.
And I've now created a running joke where every time we're at a convention with Professor Shy Guy, I try to catch him at some point, ideally when he's not busy doing other things, and say, hey, can I borrow some tape? Which most recently was at MAGFest in a hallway we were walking down, which made him stop and go, what? And then I went, it's me from Goblins and Growlers. And he's like, oh, my God.
I wonder how much of that was great. Him actually recognizing you and how much of it was him just playing along with this crazy person who was asking him about tape.
Well, this is the third time I've asked him about tape, so I'm hoping to go for number four this weekend.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure you will. I'm absolutely sure you will. but yeah, if anybody's unfamiliar with Professor Shy Guy, you should absolutely follow him on social media. He's got a Twitch that I don't think he's used in a while, at least not regularly, I don't think, since COVID. But he has a lot of great music that's out there. You should definitely check it out. And also check out the Cybertronic Spree. they're pretty fantastic too. But I say that as somebody who saw the, you know, the Transformers movie when I was like 6 years old. So
I'm going to say Cybertronics Spree is really cool, whether or not you saw the Transformers movie when you were 5 or 6 years old, because I didn't see the Transformers movie when I was 5 or 6 years old. And I think they rocked my socks off the last like 3 times I've seen them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're fantastic. And last year, I think I even texted you about this when it happened, but we're guests of the con. So we're staying at the hotel on the guest floor, and we get off the elevator and we were coming to the elevator because we were going out to get dinner, and we're waiting there at the elevator bank on the guest floor. The door opens. It's Hot Rod and RC and their handlers, and they're in full costume because Cybertronics Breed is not break kayfabe whatsoever. They are not people in robot costumes. They are robots in disguise. And they walked down to their hotel room. They were staying in the hotel room right across the hall from Milan. And I was so jealous because I was down like another door, I think. And I was so jealous. And then I think I texted you too. And I was like, I'm so terrified. I'm going to see them out of costume and it's going to destroy the illusion for me. And I think I did. Before the vendor hall opened the following morning when a bunch of us were in there doing setup. But I'm lying to myself and telling myself that I didn't see that so that I can maintain the illusion.
That could have been anybody. That could have been their cousins. You don't know.
Exactly. All I know is they had black hair and they were wearing face masks. So who knows? Who knows?
Who knows?
Yeah, but they're not going to be there this year, so that's a bummer. But Shy Guy is going to be there, and I enjoy Shy Guy's show.
Very excited to see Shy Guy.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's we're right at an hour now, and that's a lot of blather. So we'll catch up with everybody in a couple weeks. We'll have a solid topic for you, I'm sure. We've got a couple of ideas. We just need to actually make a decision, which we'll have all weekend to do.
Make a decision and then research it.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Everybody have a good one. We'll see you later.
Bye, y'all.
If you like what you hear, consider subscribing and giving us a review over on Apple Podcasts. Especially early in the feed, subscriptions and reviews are super helpful for bringing new listeners our way. Thank you!